Well, welcome back to CMDA Matters, the weekly podcast of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations, and I'm your host, Dr. Mike Chupp. I hope you had a great Easter celebration, and you are as excited as I am that spring is finally upon us. And speaking of spring, that means that our CMDA National Convention is very close. In fact, by the time you hear this podcast, less than 3 weeks away. Today, my guest is one of our featured plenary speakers that I have been so looking forward to hearing at our upcoming convention, Dr. Albert Moeller, Jr. Dr. Moeller is the president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. He is an esteemed authority on contemporary issues and has been recognized by such influential publications as Time and Christianity Today as a leader among American evangelicals. In addition to his presidential duties, he is a professor of Christian theology and hosts two different programs. One is called The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview, and the other, Thinking in Public, which is a series of conversations with today's leading thinkers. He has authored numerous books, including The Gathering Storm, Secularism, Culture, and the Church. Another is The Apostles' Creed, Discovering Authentic Christianity in an Age of Counterfeit. And another, The Prayer That Turns the World Upside Down, as well as a two-volume commentary on the Book of Acts. He also writes a popular blog and a regular commentary on moral, cultural, and theological issues. Again this week, I was joined by our CMDA Senior Vice President for Bioethics and Public Policy, Dr. Jeff Barrows, and we extended a warm welcome to one very influential Christian leader and thinker. I invite you to listen in to this conversation we had recently with Dr. Albert Moeller, who spoke with Jeff and I from his studio in Louisville, Kentucky. Well, as I kick off this interview today, I believe that many of you listening are familiar with the following daily podcast introduction done every single day, Monday through Friday, except I believe in the month of July, by our special guest on CMDA Matters. I just heard it this morning after a few bump, 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 bump. It's Thursday. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Dr. Moeller, Dr. Barrows and I have been talking about this interview for a couple of weeks now and how excited we are to get to talk to the man himself, an evangelical leader whom Time Magazine and their website called the leading intellectual of the evangelical movement in the U.S. Welcome to CMDA Matters today.
Well, doctors, it's great to be with you both. And you got that introduction exactly right. I don't think I've ever heard it in another voice. It was good.
But I shouldn't give up my day job, right?
Oh, I don't know. There could be a big future for you in this.
Oh, very good. Well, those who've been listening to CMDA Matters, our weekly podcast that we started last year, over the past several weeks, I've been telling them that you're going to be one of our plenary speakers, actually, via virtual presentation for our national convention that's at the end of next month. And I'd like to loop back, Dr. Moeller, later to talk just a little bit about your presentation. But first, I mean, our listeners, if they want to know your views and insight on a lot of things, they can turn into The Briefing. But I wanted our listeners to get to know Dr. Moeller. So for those of us who faithfully listen to The Briefing, could you tell us a little bit about your production team? And I've heard a rumor that you do this without a script, which just blows me away, having my own podcast.
Yeah, I do it without a script, and I often walk in the studio not knowing the topics I will address. And it is because things happen so fast, and also given the structure of the program, there's a first major issue that I address, and then we kind of figure out what time we have going on from there. But no, I don't have a script. I have the articles that I've marked up myself as to how I want to talk about them. And so there's an awful lot of red and blue ink all over those articles. And I walk in with them and talk about them. I did that for years with live radio, with the national radio program 5 days a week. And so it's just an extension of that.
So how big now is your regular listening audience?
You know, I think the easiest way to kind of look at it is that they're something like 100,000 people a day, something like that. And that's by podcast. And then by broadcast, we have no idea. It is many more than that. That's the best I know to say. I kind of assume that when I walk in the studio, I'm talking immediately to about 100,000 people. And then by broadcast, more than that. And so there are several radio stations and some radio networks that broadcast the briefing as a radio program. And so we have no data on that, but I'm glad to have ears here.
Well, Dr. Mueller, hearing you say that you just kind of walk in and just do the podcast right almost from scratch without a script, I've been wondering for some time. My father actually had a photographic memory. He lost that in his 30s and 40s. But wow. I have to ask, I know it's not altogether uncommon. Do you happen to have a photographic memory?
I do not. I do have a textual memory, and I kind of made that term up myself. In other words, once I read something, at least for a considerable amount of time, it's in my mind, and I wouldn't want to recite it, but the cognitive content is basically there. It doesn't stay there forever. But I do not have a photographic memory in such a way that I'd be any good as a spy. So, you know, you show me a series of numbers, and, you know, I'll forget them before you take the paper away. That's a different thing. It's ideas that my mind will fix upon in a text. And I'm thankful. I read very fast, and I tend to retain what I read. You know, I wish I retained everything, but I retained a lot, and that helps.
I'm sure it does. Well, I know that I would be interested, and many of our listeners would be interested, if you would just kind of briefly give an overview of your testimony.
Yeah, I had wonderful Christian parents, and I was born into a Christian family in Central Florida in the 1950s. That's a pretty remarkable thing, because that was like the Deep South meets the New World. Wonderful extended family. I grew up with four grandparents and lots of cousins and aunts and uncles, and a very intact culture, speaking of that, and very strong influence of Christianity. I tell people religious diversity in my world as a boy is that there was a Presbyterian family in the street. And but that was about the extent of it. I made a profession of faith when I was 9 years old in a wonderful what we would call a tall steeple Southern Baptist church, very establishment First Baptist type church. Pastor preached the word, loved me, preached the gospel, and I just felt like I was in a very nurturing Christian environment. I came to know myself as a sinner at age 9 and claimed Christ as Savior. And yet, when I was in middle school, what we then called junior high school, my father got transferred in his business down to South Florida to the Fort Lauderdale area. So my teenage years, I was kind of, you know, snatched out of a very secure context and put in a very insecure context. I can still remember the eighth grade, which was the first grade in this new place. I walked in, had an atheist teacher. I didn't know atheists existed, much less that an atheist teacher would try to, you know, push atheism on a 13-year-old. Big questions. The questions just exploded. This is when so many things are happening in the tumult of the 70s and the aftermath of the 60s, and huge questions being asked. I had an apologetic crisis. I just desperately needed to know who can answer these questions. I didn't know enough. I needed to know a lot more. Got to high school, had more atheist teachers, had good friends who were traditionalist Roman Catholics and the son of the Reformed Jewish rabbi. And then you got Moonies and Hare Krishnas on the beach. You know, what does all this mean? And thankfully, some really good influences came into my life. And some of them, you know, in person and in books, people like Francis Schaeffer. So I really became an apologist before I became a theologian. I had to work these things out because it seemed to me a matter of life and death. Mm-hmm. And there were some people who really helped me. But the vocation as a pastor, minister, theologian, philosopher, apologist, all of that really came together. So I'm sorry that was so long, but by the time I'm 18, that's really clear as a call to ministry, and this is where I am.
Let's segue to some issues that our listeners, Christians in healthcare, across the whole gamut of specialists, physicians, dentists, physician assistants, all those doing patient care, and we're right in the middle of this Equality Act mess. Sure. And we've been reading your articles and heard your podcast this week about it. Incredible insight. I wanted to ask you, I'm aware that a number of Christians, universities in particular, maybe seminaries, have been promoting the alternative fairness for all, and think, I've heard one in particular say, evangelical Christians have done such a poor disservice to the LGBT community in the past that we owe it to them to support the Fairness for All Act. What do you think about that?
Well, I just don't follow the logic. And frankly, I don't think it's intellectually honest. So I'll just speak bluntly. The Fairness for All negotiations originally came out of conversation between Mormon authorities and the LGBTQ community in Utah. And they worked together for this kind of mediating position known as Fairness for All. But it wasn't like they met at the 50-yard line. So instead, the non-discrimination LGBT legislation includes just about everything except they went on and made concessions. And the concessions were some limited concessions for religious liberty. Now, in Mormonism, that meant that there were explicit concessions made for the rights of religiously chartered institutions, et cetera, and then the Mormon church writ large. I could not accept that in the beginning, the logic of it, because basically it throws Christians, we should just say believers in this case, or religiously convicted citizens, because they could be Mormons, Orthodox Jewish professionals, they could be, you know, traditionalists, Roman Catholics, conservative Protestants. The fact is they're thrown under the bus because the only protection is given to religiously chartered institutions. And I don't think that fits the Constitution. I don't think that's right. I don't think that's a deal that we can't accept. And also, I just want to say, concessions, when they're publicly, politically recognized to be concessions, put the receiver of those concessions in a weak position. And furthermore, it generally turns out to be a temporary position.
Well, there are a couple of stories that I've been following this week, one of which is the actual hearings in the Senate for the Equality Act. And I think it was from the Human Rights Campaign, and Mr. David, who was representing them, and Abigail Schreier was there giving testimony, just talking about the impact of the Equality Act and how, from Mr. David's perspective, there was not going to be discrimination against women and girls because, look, the states like Connecticut, for example, where it's already been passed, there's not been discrimination. And I found that incredibly ironic and really untruthful, given that there's a lawsuit in Connecticut, I think we're aware of, where female athletes Absolutely. Are suing. But the other article, which I just came across today from the Daily Wire, is regarding the South Carolina state rep, Caesar McKnight, who's a Democrat, who's introduced legislation there to prohibit sex transitioning procedures and treatment in minors under age 18, and how his constituents, almost all black in his area that he represents, are all telling him, this is not anti-transgender, it's just common sense. So all that's to say, Dr. Mueller, I'm getting to, are we going to see more of this coming from conservative blacks, especially Christians, to speak out and push back, even though they're Democrats, pushing against this anti-science ideology and potentially harming their own children?
I certainly hope so. I certainly hope we see it across the board, because this is a matter of theological insanity that will lead to moral cruelty. It's embracing a lie and coercing others to embrace a lie, but it's going to have really devastating effects, as you physicians could speak, in the lives of young people. And furthermore, it's never even honestly presented. You know, this sex affirmation surgery or gender affirmation surgery. I mean, it's by the very Orwellian language that's being used, you can see exactly what it is if you have eyes to see and ears to hear. But what you're talking about is the fact that what we have is this this idea in much of society that the only dynamic that matters, the dynamic driving everything else, is a dynamic between oppression and liberation. You know, if you talk to the average college student, that is all the college student hears. That is it. I saw a college professor say the other day, all we talk about now is talking about. We don't even talk about our disciplines anymore. And it's all oppression and liberation. Now, in human history, and I think we'd all be honest, there have been situations that have to be analyzed in terms of oppression and liberation. But oppression and liberation doesn't fit every situation. And when you apply it to the transgender question, just as one example, then what you're really claiming is that the same oppressor liberation dynamic that had to be addressed in the civil rights movement, that's exactly the same dynamic when you have a teenage boy who now declares himself to be a teenage girl. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the thing. One of the political realities is that African-American leaders in the United States have often had to turn to others as allies who then are extending the same oppression liberation context to their situation. And the gay rights movement, as it was known in the beginning, explicitly, I mean, publicly said, we're going to borrow the logic of the civil rights movement. I do not believe they're the same thing. I don't think most African-American citizens believe they are the same thing. That gets to the heart of the question you ask. I think we're about to find out how many people, regardless of race and ethnicity, are willing to say publicly, this is not right. The oppressor liberation dynamic is not what's going on here. There is something even more basic that's at stake here. So I just have to hope that more people will not only believe that, but say it out loud.
I have to hope along with you, Dr. Moeller. But I'm going to shift gears a little bit here, and I want to talk briefly about the Hyde Amendment. We know that in all probability that this administration and this Congress are likely to take down the Hyde Amendment, which has protected all of us who are pro-life Christians from having to have our tax dollars spent, especially here in the United States, to fund abortions. And I guess my question to you is really on a more personal level, and that is, have you thought ahead about how you may be changing your personal financial situation in a way so that you can lessen how many taxes would go to abortion, or and give advice to those of us who haven't had the time to really think through some of these issues?
I gave a public lectureship just in recent days and took those who were in that audience back into the Gospels and the incident in which Jesus was asked about the payment of taxes to Caesar. And you recall that he asked for a coin. He took the coin and said, well, Caesar likes this so much, he put his picture on it. So render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's and unto God the things that are God's. So Jesus said, pay your taxes. When this was an idolatrous, brutal regime, the Roman Empire. Now, he didn't say anything about tax advice as to, you know, doing your very best to minimize your tax exposure and all the rest. I don't think it's wrong to minimize your tax exposure. And by the way, in every legal and appropriate way, I think it's right to try to minimize your tax exposure, just in general terms. But specifically about this, I think this is going to be a crisis of conscience for many American Christians. But we do need to be guided by Scripture and understand that until we're ready to declare that the regime, the government, is irremediably broken and opposed to God, and thus we will exit ourselves from the context of citizenship and pay the price for that, by the way. Until that point, then we basically are going to pay our taxes, but yes, I would do everything to try to minimize that in general, just because I think that's a good stewardship issue. But beyond that, given moral responsibility, I want to reduce what the government would do with my money that I believe will be illicit, wrong, immoral, and unhelpful.
Switching to a different topic, at CMDA last summer after the George Floyd death and all of the riots, and then it came out, you know, looking at COVID-19 and disparities and outcomes and deaths and so forth that was ethnically based, we actually formed a Racial Reconciliation, Equality, and Diversity Committee with some healthcare professionals, multiple ethnicities, ages, and so forth, looking at the issue of health inequities and healthcare disparities. And in the process, none of us really understood critical race theory. In fact, we never heard of it before, frankly, before last summer. And the committee comes together and realizes that there is a whole gamut of views on this critical race theory. And then many of us have been following what's been happening in the Southern Baptist Church and reading things from the president and Russell Moore and yourself. And it really has been a divisive issue. And this whole idea of wokeness, I wanted to ask you, there's been a recent article in Public Discourse by Reverend Jim Wood and wokeness and its relationship to critical race theory. And it actually has become sort of the Protestantism of our post-Christian era. Can you talk to us a little bit about this whole idea of wokeness and a pseudo-faith?
Yeah, I'm a bit down on using wokeness as the term. I understand how you're asking it and all the rest, but, and I'll tell you, it's because it's often ill-defined, and thus it ends up being just what anyone doesn't like. But look, there's a real thing there. So in other words, when I hear wokeness, I know what, in the main, people are talking about. It's this idea, and it goes back to what I was talking about with this oppressor liberation logic, that everything comes down to some oppressor liberation dynamic, and I'm on the side of liberation. I'm not on the side of the oppressor. And, you know, they often are just doing that as a matter of attitude. If you're a 21-year-old living in society today, you're on a college campus, my goodness, the whole everything's woke. So I'd like to come up with a better term for it, but let me just do a little genealogy here. At the end of the First World War, and between the two World Wars, there were some abortive efforts at kind of a Bolshevik revolution in places like Germany. It didn't happen. And there was tremendous frustration on the part of Marxists that it didn't happen. And by the way, it just raises all kinds of questions. You know, Marx and Engels said that the liberator would be the workers. The workers are going to rise up, and that just didn't happen. So out of that came, in places such as Germany, and particularly in a city called Frankfurt, came a group of philosophers who and intellectuals who called themselves critical theorists. They established a school of critical theory. And critical theory is basically Marxist analysis, which, remember that Marx said everything solid melts into air. In other words, if you use the right philosophical critique, everything that exists, and he meant by that government, economic theory, and all the rest, it's all relativized by Marxism. And so what came out of critical theory was the idea that we're not winning this Marxist revolution by means of workers in London and Edinburgh and in Berlin and Frankfurt joining a revolution. So instead, we've got to change through the culture. In the West, the culture is far more important than the political dynamic of workers in an economic revolution. We'll get to that. So critical theory, and by the way, this is one of the issues of the apologetic crisis that I had as a teenager. And so the difference is, I have to say, I had no idea that critical theory could possibly make the full arc from liberal Marxist European life to the streets of the American city and the American college campus this fast. But I was wrong. Here it is. Critical race theory is just critical theory applied to racial situations. And critical race theory came out of frustration from the left with the halfway victories, as they said, of the civil rights movement. They said the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King Jr. and others, the civil rights movement was wrong because it tried to reform what can only be replaced. And so that's the big thing right now. So I think critical race theory is one of the most dangerous, and critical theory itself, critical race theory is just a version of it. You could say critical gender theory. It's all the same. It is to try to replace the dominant worldview, to try to replace the government, to try to replace the legal system, and eventually, yes, to replace the economy, everything else, to replace an old faculty with a new faculty. You can't reform, you have to replace. And by the way, let's be really honest, and this is where a lot of the kind of, I think, young evangelicals are confused about this. Orthodox biblical Christianity is a part of what the critical theorists explicitly say must be replaced, because it's so fundamental to Western civilization, which must be replaced. That's one of the problems of critical theory, by the way, or intersectionality. So let's just say that you are a black male and you say, I have been oppressed, and thus, and in many cases, no doubt that's true and sinful and needs to be remedied. They say, but I have been oppressed. Well, by intersectionality, a black female comes up and says, well, I'm both female and black, so I'm more oppressed than you are. And then someone comes up and says, yes, but I'm this and that. Well, the intersectionality has no end. And so whoever thinks they're on top of intersectionality today, you're going to be at the bottom of the heap tomorrow. And this never ends. And that then I go back to Marx. Everything that's solid melts into air. That is the opposite of biblical Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Related to that topic, then, one of our CMDA members, who is a minority, wrote to me, and specifically talking, very familiar, I think maybe even within the Southern Baptist Church, was saying, you know, if the church would spend as much time, Dr. Chupp, on addressing the issues that are still there in terms of racism within the church and past wrongs, then I don't think there would be so much time spent talking about critical race theory in the church. Is that at all accurate or fair, Dr. Moeller, in terms of our energy, the energy to fight against critical race theory, that maybe some of that energy would be to look at past wrongs?
Well, I think there's been a lot of attention to past wrongs, and the Christian worldview is honest about this, never evasive if we're faithful to Christ. And it's not only a so what happened, but so what. And I mean, you take the Southern Baptist Convention. I was a part of writing the statement adopted by the SBC in 1995, which, by the way, condemned, not only recognized the sin of slavery in American history and in the history of the South and in the history of our own denomination and segregation, my own institution released an extremely thorough and I think very courageous report on this back in 2018.
Yes.
And condemned racism in both private and individual context and in structural context. And by the way, that was without critical race theory. No critical race theory there in 1995, just Bible. But my argument would be critical race theory, if it is not eliminated from this conversation, makes the conversation impossible to have. Critical race theory solves no problems. It simply makes it impossible because critical race theory says there can be no improvement. There can be no amelioration. And there can be no forgiveness. And I mean, Christians will say, well, obviously we don't believe in all that. And, well, I know you don't believe in all that, but it's actually, as a form of critical theory, something that's incompatible with any kind of Christian argument. So, you know, people say, why do you pay so much attention to this? I never woke up one morning wanting to talk about critical race theory. And I didn't call you and say, hey, I'd like to talk about this. The fact is that this is the question that's now being presented. The seminary presidents in the SBC, we had people all over the denomination had and have saying, you know, would you allow critical race theory to be taught in your institution? And by the way, the answer to that is an adamant, immediate no. It's incompatible with our statement of faith, which is our way of saying with what we believe biblical Christianity to be. But that does not mean, by the way, that we deny the sin of racism as sinful as it is and with a legacy with which we still have to deal and that is both individual and social, which is to say structural. I'm avoiding the word systemic because the critical race theorists have taken the word systemic and it now means that there's no part of the society that's not terminally corrupted by racism, and I don't believe that. Now, here's the other thing, just to say, as I was coming here to the studio to have this conversation with you, I was listening to one of the primary, just National Public Radio, just minutes ago, listening to one of the primary theorists of critical race theory. Just listening to him in this interview, it just struck me, there is no hope. There is nothing here but further critique. There's critique and theory. There's no hope. If Christianity stands for anything, it stands for hope. And by the way, I heard you mention you started a group that's concerned about equality and reconciliation, mm-hmm. and those are very good words. Those are not words that are used in critical race theory. They are words that are considered to be obstacles. They will say you can't talk about equality, you have to talk about equity. And reconciliation is impossible so long as the current structures are in place.
And that's certainly not our gospel.
No, and I know that you as physicians, and I really respect this, I'm alive today by the grace of God, but also by that grace mediated through some wonderful surgeons and doctors who have ministered to me in health crises. My mom was a registered nurse, by the way, and I just grew up in a context in which I so honored the medical profession. I still do. And when you start out by talking about, say, inequities that were revealed by COVID, yes, okay, so we see that. So what critical theory wants to do is to go back and say that the entire society, by an intention to oppress, has done this. Well, you know, there are truths there. There's no doubt about it. But the bigger issue is we actually want to make people well. We want to get people in situations where there are no longer these inequities. There are preconditions necessary for that. There's going to have to be health care, not just at the point of the threat of a pandemic, but there's going to have to be health disciplines. There's going to have to be, I'm going to say it as a Christian, there'll be intact communities and intact families and intact social structures that can do that. But that's not allowable as a discussion. And yet I think that's what actually will help people. And as a Christian, I want to help people. So I'm really pushing to try to get to the point where we can talk about how to help people.
Well, that really leads in, Dr. Mohler, to my next question, and that is we're very excited to have you as one of our plenary speakers at the upcoming CMDA Virtual National Convention coming up at the end of April. And I was wondering if you know yet what the Lord has put on your heart to share with us as we come to the end, hopefully come to the end of a global pandemic and look at a face-off between religious liberty and freedom of conscience and some other things that are coming at us as healthcare professionals.
Yeah, I'm going to speak from the heart on what faithfulness to Christ really requires of us. Looking at, of course, Scripture, but also just looking at examples throughout the history of the Christian church as to what faithfulness to Christ requires of us. No one said it was going to be easy, but the amazing thing is that, you know, those who demonstrated true faithfulness to Christ in the Scripture and throughout the ages did so not only with a deep conviction, but with joy. So I'm hoping it will be both an instructive word and an encouraging word.
Thank you for joining us today, and very eager to hear you challenge us about faithfulness at times like these. Thanks for joining us today.
It's been a real pleasure. God bless you both.
Well, if you enjoy golf as much as I do, and then you watch the pros on television, it just blows you away. The kinds of shots those guys make, just hole after hole, shot after shot. Well, I've been doing a podcast for 15 months, and I'm just telling you, every time I listen to the briefing with Dr. Mueller, I'm just blown away that the man can walk in with a few notes and boom, do that daily podcast. Well, if you've been listening for the last couple of weeks, you've heard about Dr. Carl Truman's new book entitled The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. I would like to send you this book as a thank you for your donation of any amount during the month of April. Just go to the link in the show notes on our CMDA Matters page at cmda.org/riseandtriumph, one word, rise and triumph. And for any donation, we will send you a copy of Dr. Truman's outstanding new book. If you'd like to read Dr. Mueller's new book, stay tuned in the month of May, because we will be featuring Dr. Mueller's book, The Gathering Storm, Secularism, Culture, and the Church, as our monthly CMDA Matters book offer next month. I look forward to sending you a copy. The CMDA Virtual National Convention is fast approaching April 29th through May 1st. Be sure to hear Dr. Mueller challenging us, as you just heard, about faithfulness and joy and what God expects from us as followers of Christ in healthcare in the United States on Friday evening, April 30th. In addition to Dr. Mueller, we have an excellent lineup of speakers this year, such as best-selling author Mr. Philip Yancey, Dr. Alveda King, niece of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and Reverend and author Burt Jones. I will also be kicking off the convention, sharing with attendees about the clarion call of God to a consecrated life. For a complete schedule for the convention, just go to cmda.org/events or click the link in the show notes. I also wanted to remind you, or maybe to put it on your radar for the very first time, that our global partner in ministry, the International CMDA Ministry, since the beginning of the pandemic, has been hosting weekly webinars. This week, our Medical Education International Ministries director will be sharing with physicians and dentists and others around the globe while being translated in 7 languages on the topic of multiplying your impact through teaching. If you'd like to participate in these webinars live, or if you'd like to view them after the fact on the ICMDA YouTube channel, just go to icmda.net and click on the button Webinars. You can find out more information and register for our CMDA US events at cmda.org/events, or you'll find links in our show notes today online.
This is Dr. Jeff Barrows giving you the Washington Update. We have been telling you that you need to know about and take immediate action to stop the so-called Equality Act. Already passed by the House, this radical bill is now awaiting a vote to be scheduled in the near future in the U.S. Senate. That vote is expected to be extremely close, following along party lines. For us as healthcare professionals, the important thing to remember is that the Equality Act would force us to ignore sound medical judgment on gender issues and end any religious protections that currently exist. I urge you to first of all learn more about the Equality Act on our Freedom to Care website. That's freedom2care.org. There you can read our CMDA letter that details the harms that the Equality Act would force upon people of faith and pro-life health professionals. Second, contact your senators using our 30-second action form that you will find at freedomtocare.org. And above all, pray. Thank you for taking action on this very important issue that affects all of us as healthcare professionals.
You just heard our guest today, Dr. Moeller, point out that he sees no hope for man's wisdom as applied in a theory like critical race theory. CRT has been widely described as a zero-sum game, a power struggle between ethnic groups with no goal of reconciliation between those viewed as offenders and those who are offended. Our hope at CMDA is in the reconciling work of Jesus Christ, who redeems what is broken and imperfect into something that can be used for His glory. Our members have dedicated their lives to healing what is broken in the name of Christ, not just physical bodies, but spiritual suffering as well. Reconciliation and advocating for those who cannot speak for themselves? Well, God's Word says that it must matter to us as Christians in healthcare, like you and me. And so it matters to CMDA, and CMDA matters. I have a special guest next week I think you will enjoy, CMDA member and psychiatrist of 40-plus years from West Virginia, Dr. Greenbrier Almond. He will join me to talk about PTSD and his new book, Coping with Crisis. Thanks for listening today. We will see you next week if the Lord tarries.
This podcast has been a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on this podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.